He gave Thatcher a pointed glance. Someone looking for a room to let? Thatcher moved in closer, wanting badly to knock this pompous hypocrite on his ass. But Bill motioned for him to stay as he was, and for the sheriff's sake, Thatcher let the insult pass. Bill said,
"A vagrant is a possibility, of course, but initial indications are that she knew her assailant and let him inside the house. Her infant was asleep in the front room, so it was someone she trusted."
The mayor drew a frown and absently toyed with his watch chain.
"What is it, Bernie?"
He stopped fiddling with the chain, but his frown remained.
"Something I wish I didn't know."
"About Miss Blanchard?"
"Yes, but I was told in the strictest confidence."
"If it's pertinent to the crime, then—"
"I'm not saying that," Croft said in a rush. "Not at all. It probably has no relevance whatsoever."
"Tell me and let me decide."
He sighed with seeming reluctance.
"On the day following Mila Driscoll's disappearance, I spoke to Gabe by telephone. Mrs. Driscoll's relatives hadn't arrived yet, so while your deputy was using the bathroom, Gabe called me on the sly and confessed that he'd had a liaison with that Blanchard girl."
"Why would he have confessed that to you?"
"Because I had been his staunch proponent there in your office. I had promised to continue standing by him until his wife was found or her fate determined. Therefore, he felt I deserved to know that he had harbored what he called a shameful secret. I was thinking in terms of unsettled gambling debts or blackmail or fleecing hypochondriacs, something like that. I never would have dreamed that Gabe Driscoll's dirty secret was a sexual fling. He's such a cold fish."
"I can't imagine him humping anybody, can you?"
Thatcher could tell that Bill was offended by Croft's terminology, but he pounced on the primary matter.
"After that rousing sermon you just delivered about your civic responsibility, you tell me this? Why didn't you come to me with it before now? You didn't think an affair with another woman was pertinent to the sudden disappearance of the man's wife?"
"Calm down. It wasn't an affair. It was one afternoon of sexual congress that occurred the day after he and the Blanchard woman met."
"Only that one time?"
"That's what he told me, tearfully, with contrition. Soon after this breach of his marriage vows, Mrs. Driscoll conceived. Gabe regarded her pregnancy as a sign of forgiveness from on high."
Even though Mrs. Driscoll was blissfully unaware of his transgression, he atoned by lavishing attention on her, pampered her with foot rubs, picnics in her favorite spot near Pointer's Gap, flowers and other romantic fol-de-rol. He never strayed again. I made him swear it on the Bible. Mrs. Kemp had told Thatcher and Bill a completely different story, but it wasn't his place to cite that.
Bill said, "Although it's late in coming, thank you for this information, Bernie."
"I doubt it's relevant to what happened to the girl. If the rumor mill is credible, encounters such as the one she had with Gabe were not a rarity, but commonplace."
"Nevertheless, she suffered a brutal attack. I ask again for your discretion."
"Of course, Bill, of course. Good night."
Croft tapped his thigh. The dog trotted up and rejoined his master, tongue lolling, tail wagging, ready to be off. As Croft came even with Thatcher, he said,
"Deputy Hutton, don't think for a moment that badge on your chest makes me in any way nervous."
"I don't, but I don't wear it all the time. That's when you should be nervous."
Thatcher watched Hennessy hold open the backseat door of the town car for Croft and the bird dog.
"Your mayor is the one who's got a shadow."
Bill looked over at the town car, then motioned Thatcher toward his own vehicle.
"I don't mind walking. I've got to go to the office anyway and finish the paperwork I started with Doc Perkins. But do you mind if I make a quick stop at home so I can give Daisy the stomach medication?"
"Not at all."
Once they were on their way, Bill said,
"As bodyguards go, Bernie couldn't have hired a better one. Jimmy Hennessy, I doubt that's his real name, was in the IRA. fought in the uprising in 17. Got a price put on his head for killing two British Army officers. Outran his pursuers and made it to New York. Due to the large Irish population there, word got around. Traitors talked, the city got too hot for him. He fled to Chicago. Same story there. Eventually, he wound up here. All this is hearsay, you understand, probably embellished, but I believe the basics. Bill made a corner, then said, "Only one afternoon of illicit romance? Do you believe that version?" "No. Why would Mrs. Kemp exaggerate her sister's promiscuity in the wrong direction?"
"Exactly.
And why did Driscoll do the opposite and swear on the Bible that he was with Norma Blanchard only once?"
"We'll ask him that tomorrow."
"Why not now?"
"I want to see what evidence the Kemp house yields. When we confront Gabe with this, I want to be as well-armed as possible."
When they arrived at the Amos' house, Thatcher said he would wait in the car. "Take your time. I've got a lot to mull over." Such as Laurel being a moonshiner, out of her league with big-time players like Landry and Croft, the Johnsons, and the unscrupulous couple at Lefty's.
Jesus.
Bill found Daisy in bed, listless and complaining of stomach cramps. He asked if she'd eaten anything, but she hadn't because she couldn't keep anything down.
"Have you been drinking?"
"No, Bill."
She reached for his hand and held it against her cheek. She was lying. He could smell whiskey on her breath, but he didn't want to start a row. She wasn't drunk, but she was obviously unwell. He gave her half a dropper of the medicine.
"Maybe it'll ease the cramping so you can sleep. I won't be long."
"I love you."
"I love you too."
He kissed her forehead. Her eyes drifted closed. It scared him how fragile she looked, almost lifeless. Shaking off that thought, he left the bedroom and had almost reached the front door when the telephone rang. He went back to answer it and could tell by the background noise coming through the earpiece that his long and strenuous day wasn't over yet. 60 seconds later, he strode to the car and climbed into the driver's seat.
"Thatcher, do you have a gun belt?"
"At the boarding house."
"Then we'll stop there first."
"What's happened?"
"That moonshine war I knew was coming? Well, it's here."
48. Thatcher was putting the frisky mare through her paces in the corral when he saw Laurel come around the corner of the stable. She stopped there. The sight of her made his heart jump and everything below his waist go tight, which didn't improve his dark mood this morning. He wanted to strangle her for being the damnedest woman he'd ever met. He wanted to make love to her for the same reason. The mare was being her uncooperative self, but he stuck with the training for 5 more minutes, then with a subtle motion of his right knee, directed her to the paddock gate where he dismounted. He led her out and over to the water trough near the stable. He said to Laurel,
"You're out early."
"I need to talk to you and figured I would find you here."
Her hair was hanging down her back in a long braid beneath the straw hat he recognized, the one with the wide brim that cast a crisscrossing pattern of shadows over her cheeks, her pert nose, her plump lower lip. To distract himself from thoughts of biting that lip, he ran his hand along the horse's neck as she drank from the trough. Laurel said,
"What's her name?"
"Serena."
"Pretty."
"Yeah, but it doesn't fit her personality. She's high-stepping and willful, doesn't pay attention to anybody."
He could tell by Laurel's peeved expression that she knew he wasn't referring strictly to the mare. In a crisp voice, she said,
"I wouldn't have bothered you, except that I need to tell you something the sheriff ought to know."
"Then why don't you go see him?"
"Are you going to be civil and talk to me or not?"
"I'll be civil and talk to you, but I can tell you right now that you won't want to hear what I have to say."
"And what is that?"
"Stay and find out."
He made a nicking sound with his mouth and gave the reins a gentle tug. The mare fell into step behind him as he led her into the stable,
Laurel trailed behind. The shade was welcome, but the air inside the building was stuffy and hot and added to his overall grouchiness. Only after the mare was unsaddled, unbridled, and munching oats in her stall did he turn his attention to Laurel, who'd been standing in the center aisle, tapping her hat against her leg with annoyance for having been kept waiting.
"You don't like horses?" he asked.
"I don't mind them."
"Do you ride?"
"Not with any skill. On the family farm, we had plow horses and one mule. I could sit astride and hold on. What is it you wanted to say that I don't want to hear?"
"Have a seat."
He motioned to a bale of hay. She backed up to it and sat down. He took off his hat and hung it on a nail as he wiped his forehead with his sleeve.
"I've got a bucket of well water. Are you thirsty?"
"No, thanks."
He went over to the bucket, ladled himself a tin cupful, and drank it down. She set her hat on her lap. When he came back to her, he propped himself against a post between stalls.
"Ladies first."
"There's something worth Sheriff Amos's knowing, especially after what happened to El Rey Johnson."
"Why don't you tell him directly?"
"Because you're privy to certain things that he isn't."
"Like what?"
"My visit to Lefty's. Have you mentioned that to him?"
"No."
"Or that I've taken Corinne under my wing?"
"No."
She wet her lips, pulled that enticing lower one through her teeth, making it difficult for him to concentrate on what she was saying.
"So, last night, I tested my memory of what Corinne had told me before. She described again how furious Gert was with Wally over the beating, not because she had any sympathy or concern for Corinne, but because she was going to lose money while Corinne was out of commission."
She paused to take a breath.
"It occurred to me that Gert might have killed Wally over it."
"Huh.
You sound skeptical. Don't you think she's capable of murder?"
He thought back on his single experience with the woman and the fury she'd unleashed during the raid.
"I don't doubt it for a minute."
"But what?"
"A lot of people are capable of murder. Gert has her own suspect in mind. She thinks Wally was killed by the woman who has put a cog in the local moonshining machine. Remember, that's what El Rey told me seconds before he got shot."
"Of course I remember. But does this mystery woman even exist? Gert probably made that up to deflect—"
"Laurel, stop. Just stop."
He walked over, grabbed her hand, and pulled her to her feet, sending her hat into the dirt and shocking her into silence.
"Do you think I'm just a cowboy too dumb to know what you're into?"
"What do you mean?"
"Fucking hell,"
he ground out, not caring if she was scandalized by his language.
"Finding that hair clip where the still had been clinched it, but I already knew that you and Irv weren't living off pies in his handyman business. I know the O'Connor twins wouldn't be delivering baked goods for Christ's sake, to the oil fields if there wasn't more at stake."
"They—"
"Don't say anything. I don't want to hear anymore. I can't hear anymore. I'm official now."
"Just because you made that grand gesture of pinning on the badge?"
"Because Sheriff Amos swore me in as a reserve deputy last night."
"Oh, I see."
She pulled her hand free of his grip, but he wrapped his hands around her upper arms and held her in place.
"Know why he needed another deputy? To try to keep moonshiners from killing each other."
"Killing each other?"
"The war Bill Amos saw coming was declared."
"What happened?"
"Three stills belonging to members of the Johnson family were destroyed by rivals."
"Who?"
"Don't know yet, but the outbreak of violence went on for most of the night. Stills were busted up. The hills ran with rivers of whiskey that had been poured out, sometimes by the sheriff's men, sometimes by competing sides, and it was hard to tell who was who. There were several shootouts, them against each other, them against us."
"You were in on these shootouts?"
"Because men were shooting at me, at Bill, at all of us. One of the other reserve deputies got winged. Best I know, nobody died, but it wasn't for lack of trying. Sheriff's department arrested over 20 men. Bill had them scattered to different jails, in this county and neighboring ones.
He did that for their own safety. Those who name names don't live long. If Elray was here, he'd vouch for that.
She had stopped trying to get free. In fact, she was gazing up at him with apprehension.
Do you know the names of those who were put in jail?
Her face had gone pale.
He knew what she was desperate to know, but couldn't come right out and ask.
There were no familiar names on the lists I saw. Only when he said that did she begin to breathe again.
I've warned you before, Laurel, and it hasn't done a damn bit of good. Maybe because I beat around the bush. But I'm going to tell you straight out this time.
He drew her closer.
If you don't stop what you're dealing in and making enemies with folks like Chester Landry, Gert, the Johnsons, you could wind up hurt or even dead.
Listen to me, damn it.
Retaliation seems to be the only way these people know how to settle a disagreement or even a grudge.
Thinking back on Norma Blanchard, he added, being a woman won't protect you from violence or cruelty. Believe that. He rubbed her arms up and down once, then released her.
You've made it plain enough that I have no say in how you choose to live your life, and you don't want me to have a say. But the fear of something bad happening to you keeps me churned up and makes me mad as hell at you. That's why I acted like a jackass when you got here.
She looked down.
I thought you were mad because I made you stop the other night.
I wasn't happy about it.
I know. I'm sorry.
Don't apologize. It was my fault. I read you wrong.
She tilted her head up, looked at him directly, and said softly,
I'm only sorry that I didn't see it through. I'd like to know what I missed.
He waited to make sure he hadn't imagined that she'd said that, but her green eyes reflected sincerity, regret, and yearning. He slid his hand beneath her braid and curved it around the back of her neck.
I damn near died. I'm damn near dying now.
He lowered his head. Their lips barely touched.
Thatcher, you in there?
He and Laurel sprang apart. Standing in the wide stable opening was Sheriff Amos, silhouetted by blinding sunlight.
Yeah, here.
The sheriff came forward a few steps, spotted Laurel, and took in the situation immediately.
Oh, excuse me.
Just as well you're here.
Thatcher bent down and picked up Laurel's hat and handed it to her.
Mrs. Plummer actually came to ask me to give you a message. Now she can deliver it herself.
Laurel looked up at him with consternation, but she went along without protest when he motioned her forward. They met Bill halfway.
How's your father-in-law, Mrs. Plummer? He asked.
Much better, thank you.
Glad to hear it.
Thatcher said,
Bill, you remember the young woman Wally Johnson beat up?
Of course, Corinne something.
Well?
Thatcher took a breath and told the sheriff about taking Corinne from Lefty's following the raid.
The Plummers sort of inherited her that night. They've given her a home in exchange for her helping out.
Really?
Bill looked at Laurel.
That was a very kind gesture, Mrs. Plummer.
Corinne was in an awful situation, not one of her own choosing.
Tell Bill what she told you about Gert.
She went on a tirade over the Wally Johnson incident.
Laurel talked without interruption for the next several minutes. She finished by saying,
Isn't it possible Gert was angry enough to kill him over it?
Bill didn't dismiss the conjecture out of hand, but he did make a valid point.
Could this be Corinne's way of getting revenge on Gert for mistreating her?
Corinne's not conniving. She's candid. She isn't lying about this. I'm sure of it.
I don't believe she is either, Bill, Thatcher said.
No, me neither, really, Bill said. I questioned her myself.
He chuckled.
She was very outspoken about her feelings over Wally's demise. And I wouldn't put anything past Gert, including cold-blooded murder. Her greediness is legendary.
He stroked his mustache.
The only thing I can't reconcile is why Corinne didn't tell me about Gert's tirade when I questioned her.
Probably because she feared reprisal. She didn't feel free to tell about it until she had gotten away from there. Her intention wasn't to implicate Gert, that's my notion. But if Gert were to find out that Corinne had talked about it at all, she could still retaliate.
I'll definitely follow up, but I'll leave the girl out of it, I promise. Thank you for bringing it to my attention.
You're welcome. Laurel put on her hat. If you gentlemen will excuse me, I need to get to work.
The three of them left the stable together. Bill said,
Thatcher, we need to get to work too. I'll meet you at the car.
He struck out in the direction of the auto garage. Thatcher asked Laurel where she'd parked.
I walked over. I didn't want it to look like...
Like you were coming to see me.
She shrugged, guilty.
People talk.
People can go to hell.
He ducked his head under her hat brim and gave her a lingering kiss. When he pulled away, he said,
I'm making you a promise, Laurel.
She looked at him quizzically.
If I ever get you in bed again, you can count on finding out what you missed.
Excited by Thatcher's final words to her, but also shaken by what he had told her about last night's unrest, the arrests, the shootouts, Laurel swiftly walked home. She planned to hastily gather supplies and then to drive out to the stills. She feared what she might find when she got there, and was equally afraid of finding nothing. By the time she reached her house, she was winded, but when she saw Irv's truck there, she ran inside. He was standing at the cook stove, cracking eggs into a skillet. She rushed over and hugged him from behind.
Ouch! Mind my arm!
Irv, I'm so relieved. My God! Last night...
Don't have to tell me about it. I lived through it.
He flipped the frying eggs.
You want an over-easy?
No, thank you. Are Corinne and Ernie all right?
They're fine. Pissed off because we couldn't do runs last night, just when we were rebuilding our inventory. By the way, I brought back crates packed with jars. I'll help you carry them down to the cellar once I've had a bite and a rest.
Fine, good. But what about last night?
We were all set to get both cookers going, but then we started hearing gunfire popping from every direction. Some of it might have been echoes, but there was enough of it, and close enough, to scare the bejesus out of us. We knew better than to light the fireboxes and become targets, so we scurried a distance away and took cover between rocks, huddled in the dark all night. Shooting would break out every now and then. Didn't let up till almost dawn. We were glad to be alive to see the sunrise. Went back to the camp. Looked just like when we left it. They didn't find us.
He slid the eggs onto a plate, sprinkled both liberally with salt and pepper, and added a leftover biscuit. As he hobbled over to the table, he remarked,
Your color is hectic. What's the matter?
What's the matter?
She sat down across from him.
When you weren't here this morning, I thought you'd probably stayed at the stills all night because you were tired of being cooped up for so long. But when I heard about last night's ruckus...
Who do you hear it from?
He mopped up egg yolk with half the biscuit and popped it into his mouth.
Thatcher Hutton.
He gave a harumph.
Figures.
Why do you say that?
Did he come around to boast about all the men he killed?
He didn't kill anybody.
Not what I heard. The boys at the filling station said...
The filling station?
Stop there on my way into town. It's where you go to get a soda pop and the latest news. Word is that Hutton's the sheriff's new sharpshooter. Said he dropped at least a dozen men last night. They say he's taken the sheriff's boy Tim's place in his daddy's affection.
Said nobody was killed.
Then why'd he come over here if not to brag?
One of his eyebrows went up, the other down.
Or don't I know?
She ignored the implication.
Actually, today I went looking for him to ask if he would pass along some information to the sheriff.
She explained why she thought the blowout that Corinne had witnessed between Gert and Wally Johnson was important.
Things were peaceful around here before that jug-eared runt was murdered, Irv said. Now look where we're at. Folks shooting at each other.
He crumbled the second half of the dry biscuit into the remaining egg yolk.
What about the O'Connors? Do you know how they fared last night?
They weren't around. They were making a delivery to Ranger.
That was mighty convenient.
Why are you still mistrustful of them?
He waved his hand in dismissal.
They ain't at the top of my worry roster. Deputy Hutton holds that spot. Laurel, if you keep seeing him on a regular basis...
It's not on a regular basis.
He's going to find us out.
He already has.
Irv wiped a napkin over his mouth, then held it there as she told him about Thatcher finding the barrette at the abandoned still site.
It was Corinne's, but it matched ones he'd seen me wear. A hair clip isn't conclusive evidence, of course, but even before he found it, he suspected.
Has he come right out and accused you?
Not exactly.
Not exactly?
We talk around it. For instance, he let me know that you and Corinne hadn't been arrested last night by saying he didn't recognize any names on the lists of arrests. He warns me to be careful.
Of the likes of the O'Connors and that Chester Landry. But maybe he's the one you should be more careful of.
He wears a badge now, but I truly believe he's looking out for us, Irv. He doesn't want us to get caught.
For his sake as well as ours.
How so?
He thought over his answer.
Men like Hutton have this fortitude, honor, whatever you want to call it. Unlike the most of us, it's hard to bend and damn near impossible to break. If he was put in a position of letting you off the hook or enforcing the law he's now sworn to uphold, which do you figure he'd do?
I don't know, and neither do you.
No, but I think he knows. That's why he doesn't want you to get caught.
49. As Thatcher and Bill left Barker's garage, Bill told him they were headed for Gabe Driscoll's house.
You're going to question him about the attack on Norma Blanchard.
I am, but I should inform you that you're still Bernie's first-choice suspect. He put in a call to me early this morning. He asked if I'd ascertained, his word, your whereabouts at the time Norma Blanchard was assaulted.
Should I take that personally?
Bill chuckled.
He's never going to like you, Thatcher.
That doesn't hurt my feelings. I don't like him either. We rubbed each other the wrong way from the start.
Because you see through him. Also, he senses that you can't be corrupted or controlled.
Bill gave him a sad look that said, unlike me.
Gotta ask, Bill, was he behind all that shit that happened last night?
I accused him.
And?
What do you think?
He was walking his dog when it started.
Thatcher swore.
We're his damn alibi.
Hennessy's too. Although Bernie wouldn't have wasted Hennessy on raiding other people's stills, but you can bet orders came from Bernie.
What's he after?
The Johnsons' almost monopoly on the boomtowns?
Thatcher said nothing for a time, thinking about the tightening web of danger being spun around Laurel. Then he asked Bill if Dr. Perkins's medicine had helped Mrs. Amos's stomach ailment. Last night, while Thatcher was retrieving his gun belt from his room, Bill had commandeered the boarding house telephone to call a woman in Daisy's Bridge Club, who had readily agreed to go sit with Mrs. Amos until Bill returned home, whenever that might be.
The tincture seems to have helped. She hasn't thrown up again, but she was very weak this morning. I hope she can be persuaded to eat something. Her friend Alice Cantor said she would stay with her for however long she's needed.
That's a huge relief.
It is. My county was on fire last night, and probably will be again tonight. I've called in all my reserve deputies to help the regulars, but, hell, at least half of them make moonshine themselves or take graft from those who do. That mess, along with the Blanchard assault, it's like the damn sky is falling. Hated to pull you away from whatever you were doing at the stable.
Thatcher gave a half laugh. He didn't hate it near like Thatcher did. He'd have liked to have had more time alone with Laurel. Now, however, he needed to concentrate on the upcoming interview with Dr. Driscoll. Weeks ago, he'd realized that he would never be entirely cleared of suspicion in Mrs. Driscoll's disappearance until someone else was proved to be the culprit. Even though he'd joined the ranks on the side of the law last night, he still wasn't wholeheartedly accepted by the other men. The more Bill relied on him, consulted him on tactics and so forth, the more resentment Thatcher felt aimed his way. This interrogation of Driscoll could turn that tide.
"I went out early to the Kemp house," Bill was saying. "Took a look around. It's as Mrs. Kemp described it. Norma's room looked like a tornado had hit it. There was blood on the bed. I left Scotty out there to try and lift fingerprints, but if they do turn out to match Gabe Driscoll's, all that proves is that he's been there, which we already know. Doesn't signify that he assaulted her."
"Where does that leave you?"
"Us. That's why I called you away from your work at the stable. You factor large in our approach."
"How?"
Bill took a sheet of folded paper from the breast pocket of his jacket and passed it to Thatcher, who unfolded the sheet and read the lines written in a spidery script. When he finished, he refolded the sheet and handed it back to Bill. Thatcher said, "You're going to show this to Gabe Driscoll and gauge his reaction?"
"I'm going to show it to him," Bill said,
as he slowed his car in front of the Driscoll house.
"You're going to gauge his reaction."
As they went up the walk, Thatcher noticed that without the kind-hearted lady of the house there to oversee its upkeep, the place was beginning to look neglected. Weeds were sprouting in the flower beds. The grass needed mowing. The sign at the gate had indicated that the doctor was in, but there were no other autos there, and when Bill rang the doorbell, it echoed through empty rooms. Thatcher hadn't seen Gabe Driscoll since the morning in the sheriff's office, when the doctor had viciously accused him of abducting his wife. In the intervening weeks, his hairline had receded, he'd lost a considerable amount of weight, and his eyes were sunken into their sockets. He looked like a man who'd just crawled out of a hole or was about to crawl into one. Upon seeing them, he clutched the door jamb.
"Mila?"
"No, Gabe, sorry," Bill said, "but we'd like to speak with you. Are you with a patient?"
He shook his head, and after a second's hesitation, stood aside and motioned them in. Bill removed his hat and used it to gesture toward Thatcher.
"You remember Mr. Hutton?"
"I couldn't very well forget him."
The doctor regarded him with hostility.
"I thought you were on your way to the Panhandle."
"Change of plans." Bill said, "I've made him a reserve deputy."
The doctor tilted his head as though the sheriff might be joking and would add a punchline. Realizing Bill was serious, he said,
"If this isn't about Mila, why are you here?"
"We need your professional opinion on the matter."
Still looking puzzled and a bit uneasy, he said,
"Let's talk in my office. The other rooms aren't... I haven't had anyone in to clean."
He led the way and pointed them into chairs facing his desk. The doctor went around and sat down behind it. They didn't make small talk. Bill leaned forward and passed Gabe the folded sheet of paper he'd shown Thatcher in the car.
He said, "Yesterday, a woman was brought to Dr. Perkins. She was unconscious, her condition life-threatening. She soon died. Since it was obvious that she had been the victim of a violent crime, at my request, Dr. Perkins compiled a comprehensive list of her more serious injuries."
As the doctor's eyes scanned down the sheet, his brow became increasingly furrowed. When he reached the final two notations, he murmured,
"Good God."
Bill said,
"I had her transported to Dallas for the autopsy."
"Why did you bring this to me?"
"Doc Perkins is earnest and hardworking, but he's the first to admit that he's not as knowledgeable in modern medicine as you are. I'd like to know if you agree with his hypothetical notes on how the victim's injuries were inflicted. I could wait on the autopsy report, but that may take days, if not weeks. I want to move on this. The perpetrator must be found."
"Without examining the woman myself."
"I realize I'm placing you at a disadvantage. I'm asking for a general assessment only. Generally speaking, do you agree with Dr. Perkins's hypotheses?"
Looking dubious, Driscoll ran his finger down the page.
"Well, yes. Based on his descriptions, I would say someone hit her in the face repeatedly and hard enough to break bones, Probably with his fist, but it could have been an instrument. And if the infliction is violent enough, blunt force to an organ can cause it to bleed even if it doesn't rupture. Dr. Perkins's description of the bruise on her back above her kidney indicates to me that she was stomped on rather than kicked. In regards to the rape, I concur with him. It wasn't about sexual gratification. It was defilement, and had to be sheer torture for the poor woman.
Bill said quietly, "It was Norma Blanchard, Gabe."
The doctor's face went as white as the sheet of paper that drifted out of his fingers as they went slack. He began breathing hard and fast through his mouth. He blinked rapidly. Thatcher thought he might be on the verge of passing out. He tried to stand, but his knees buckled, and he dropped back into the seat of his chair. He planted his elbows on the surface of his desk and held his head between his hands.
"Gabe," Bill said.
For the longest time, he didn't respond. Then,
"Who did it?"
"We don't know yet, but we intend to find out. We thought you might shed some light on that since you were well acquainted with Miss Blanchard."
Driscoll lowered his hands from his head and looked from Bill to Thatcher and then back to Bill. Their expressions must have been telling. His shoulders slumped.
"You know."
"About your affair with her? Yes."
"Patsy told you?"
"We spoke with her before she left to accompany Miss Blanchard's body to Dallas."
His prominent Adam's apple bobbed.
"What about the baby?"
"Mrs. Kemp arranged for a woman to look after him until further notice."
Looking dazed, the doctor listened as Bill gave him a summary of what Patsy Kemp had told them.
"This morning, one of my deputies checked with the bank. The telephone call appears to have been a ruse to get Mrs. Kemp out of the house. This wasn't a crime of opportunity. Mrs. Kemp arrived home to find the door unlocked, Norma on her bed. The baby, thank God, was unharmed."
Bill leaned forward in his chair and asked softly,
"Is the child yours, Gabe?"
His voice was a croak, but his answer was swift, simple, and unequivocal.
"Yes."
Bill let that settle, then asked,
"Had you and Miss Blanchard planned to marry?"
He was about to speak, thought better of it, and finally said,
"I'm married to Mila."
"But did Miss Blanchard have expectations of taking her place?"
"I told her that making our affair public would be regarded with scorn."
"Especially in light of Mrs. Driscoll's disappearance," Bill said. "You can understand why folks might jump to judgment."
He looked at each of them in turn, as though pleading for absolution.
"I'm not proud of committing adultery. I didn't go looking for it. I'm not like that."
"Like what?"
"A skirt chaser, a tomcat. I'd been faithful to Mila. But the moment I saw Norma, she took my breath."
"How soon before you became lovers?"
"The very next day."
He gave an account that matched Patsy Kemp's.
"And you kept going back?"
He nodded morosely.
"I couldn't stay away from her. She was like a drug. I couldn't get enough. She was so exotically beautiful and..."
He looked down at the sheet of paper on his desk and made a choking sound.
"Who would do that to her?"
"A rival for her affection?"
The doctor blinked several times.
"What?"
"Meaning no disrespect to Miss Blanchard," Bill said. "And I hate to ask so bluntly, Gabe. But even after the two of you became involved, did she see other men?"
"No,"
he exclaimed.
"No, we're in love. She had a very passionate nature and expressed her affection for me without inhibition. There was no one else."
"Okay."
Bill looked and sounded unconvinced.
"When did you last see her?"
"About 10 days ago. She showed up here unexpectedly. She brought Arthur with her. At first I was annoyed. It was the middle of the day."
"You were afraid of what people would think?"
"Yes. She laughed off my concern, said it would look like she was bringing the baby for treatment."
"How long did she stay?"
"About an hour, maybe a little longer."
Is that the first time you'd seen her since Mrs. Driscoll disappeared?
The doctor's eyes darted furtively between Thatcher and Bill. Then he confessed to the late-night visit Thatcher had witnessed.
She came uninvited then, too. I didn't want to let her in, but Norma could be persuasive, a little pushy even.
A little pushy. Bill assumed a thoughtful expression.
Did her pushiness ever lead to arguments? Did you part on good terms the last time you saw her?
There was a noticeable hesitation before he said,
Yes, I enjoyed having that time with my son.
When Bill didn't continue, but only steadily watched him, he blurted,
But I told Norma that for appearance's sake, I would come to her from then on.
Did you go to her yesterday afternoon, Gabe?
Driscoll shot a look toward Thatcher, looking like a creature who'd just realized he'd been cornered. Going back to Bill, he said,
You think I did that to Norma? That's what this is about?
He lurched to his feet and with contempt took a swipe at the sheet of paper on his desk and sent it flying.
I would never, could never do that to her. I loved her.
Sit down, Gabe.
How can she be dead?
He said, his voice cracking.
I did not harm her.
I'm glad to hear it. Sit down and tell me about yesterday. Where were you mid-afternoon, say between 1:30 and 3:30?
The doctor assumed a posture of righteous indignation. Bill waited him out. After half a minute, Driscoll lowered himself into his chair.
I haven't called on my rural patients since Mila's been missing. I resumed my route yesterday.
Why yesterday? Any particular reason?
I felt it was time that I stopped dwelling on my personal tragedy and got back to work.
Can you provide us with the names of the people you saw and the route you took?
Of course.
He took a fountain pen and paper from his lap drawer and began listing names. When he finished, Thatcher sat forward, took the paper from him, and pocketed it.
Thank you, Gabe, Bill said. I talked myself dry and could do with a glass of water. Mr. Hutton?
Sounds good.
Thatcher could tell that Driscoll saw through the ploy and didn't like leaving them, but his other choice was to appear overly nervous.
Of course.
He got up and left the room. His footsteps echoed down the hallway toward the back of the house. Bill leaned toward Thatcher, his eyebrows raised in an unspoken question.
He believes the baby is his, Thatcher said quietly. He's convinced that her love was true and that he was her only lover. He's lying about them parting on good terms, though. There was something there.
I caught that, too. Maybe she was being pushy about marriage plans. He was afraid of public opinion. That would have given him a motive to shut her up, and yesterday's route gave him opportunity.
Thatcher stated flatly,
I don't think he did it.
Bill was taken aback.
Why not? If he'd have inflicted those injuries, he'd have come apart while he was talking through them.
He lied to Bernie about seeing Norma only one time. He gave a good performance of an hysterical husband the morning after Mila's disappearance.
But he wasn't at the scene of the crime.
Thatcher bent down and picked up Dr. Perkins's list from the floor.
This amounts to the scene of the crime. I don't believe he did these things.
But
I think he got rid of Mrs. Driscoll.
To be with Norma.
He admitted that he couldn't help himself, that she was a drug and he couldn't get enough. Guys in the trenches would say he was pussy-whipped.
What do you say?
That's my thinking, too.
Bill gave him a wry grin, but it was short-lived and turned into a frown.
We don't have a body, Thatcher. Not a solid clue as to what happened to Mila.
As you know, the prosecutor won't indict on circumstantial evidence alone. A mistress, even an exotically beautiful, sexually uninhibited one, isn't evidence.
Thatcher said,
Well then, only one thing left to do.
Let him get away with it?
Get him to confess.
Before Bill could comment, they heard Gabe returning. He walked into the room carrying a glass of water in each hand. He set one in front of Thatcher, the other in front of Bill, and returned to his chair behind the desk.
Then the three sat with nobody saying anything. Bill drank from his water glass, then smoothed his mustache, as he did when muddling through a dilemma. This time, however, Thatcher believed it was more for effect. Finally, he said,
"Gabe, the view from where I'm sitting doesn't look good. Within 2 months' time, your wife has gone missing, and your mistress died of injuries sustained during a brutal sexual assault."
Gabe swallowed audibly but didn't say anything. Bill continued,
"Now either the stars just really aren't lining up favorably for you, or an enemy is setting you up to do you in, or you're doing yourself in. Help me out here."
The doctor took several shallow breaths, like he was pumping up his courage.
"I've owned up to having a passionate affair with Norma. Like all lovers, we had our spats, but I would never have done to her what was done."
"You were with her on two separate occasions the day Mrs. Driscoll disappeared."
Mention of that out of context momentarily flustered him.
"I told you that myself."
"I remember."
Bill looked down and seemed to study the pattern of the rug between his boots. When he raised his head, he said,
"Do you want to change anything you've told me about your activities on that day and evening?"
"No."
Bill looked over at Thatcher, his expression pained. Going back to the doctor, he said,
"What you told me about that day was that a patient, as of then unnamed, was going through a difficult breech birth. According to Mrs. Kemp, that's not true. She said Arthur was already a month old. Which one of you is lying?"
Gabe placed his elbow on his desk again and rubbed his forehead.
"I thought it would make me look bad if you knew I'd been with my mistress that night."
"Well, you're right about that."
Thatcher cleared his throat. Bill said,
"Mr. Hutton, something on your mind?"
"Uh-huh. I recall Mrs. Kemp's description of Dr. Driscoll when he went back to her house that second time late that night. She said he was frantic."
Bill said,
"He's right, Gabe, she did say that. Why were you frantic?"
"Because Norma wasn't there and I needed her."
"Needed her for what?"
"I'd just come from that ratty roadhouse where I'd tended to that girl. I think her name was Corinne. It had been a long day. I was exhausted."
"You went seeking the womanly kind of comfort Miss Blanchard could give you?"
"You're putting words in my mouth."
"Then, in your words, why were you frantic?"
"Because Norma wasn't there."
"That's close, but not exactly what we were told," Thatcher said. "Mrs. Kemp's words were that when you got there, you were batshit crazy. You didn't get upset after learning that Miss Blanchard wasn't there. You were unhinged when you arrived."
Softly, Bill said,
"Why, Gabe?"
The crack-up was gradual. It seemed to Thatcher that it started at his thinning hairline and worked its way down his long face. His brows drew together above the bridge of his nose. His eyes filled with tears. The tip of his nose turned red and dripped a bead of snot. Then his lower lip began to quiver, and he blubbered,
"I did something terrible."
50. Somewhere between his blubbered, "I did something terrible," and the sheriff's office, Gabriel Driscoll grew a pair. That was the only explanation Thatcher had for the doctor's change of heart. By the time he and Bill escorted him into the building, he had gone from a shattered man facing ruin to a haughty, self-righteous jerk. Scotty and Harold, who were sharing a desk piled high with paperwork, stopped sorting through it and looked on with interest as Driscoll proclaimed that an affair was the only thing he had confessed to, and that if the sheriff and his fledgling deputy thought otherwise, they had misunderstood. As though addressing a jury, he took the opportunity to profess his innocence.
"When I said I'd done a terrible thing, I was referring to my infidelity, nothing more. I sinned against my wife. And since you and your inept staff here haven't uncovered a single clue as to what happened to her, she'll never know how deeply I cared for her."
Looking at Thatcher with malice, he said,
You still haven't definitively accounted for yourself the night Mila disappeared. Then he turned to Bill. I'm not saying another word without a lawyer present.
Do you have one?
Not on retainer.
I'll arrange for one then. In the meantime, you'll wait in a cell.
He instructed Harold to lock him up. As the deputy escorted Driscoll into the cell block, Bill quietly said to Thatcher,
I'm in no rush to call the public defender. Let's give him a while to ruminate on his sins against his wife.
When asked, Scotty gave Bill an update on the investigations being conducted relating to last night's events.
We ran down two more Shiners trying to disassemble their still for relocation. I think they were relieved it was us who found them and not the Johnsons.
Remember that the Johnsons were the targets and suffered the greatest losses, Bill said.
Which is why they'll be primed for revenge, Scotty said. I think we can look forward to another active night. Meanwhile,
he passed Bill a slip of paper. Somebody from the governor's office. He's called twice. Asked you to call him back.
He say what for?
He said the governor wants to know what the fuck is going on out here and what in holy hell you're doing about it. Says moonshine wars make the state look bad.
The governor didn't have the guts to call and tell me himself?
He was giving the invocation at a prayer breakfast. They all had a chuckle.
Harold returned. Bill asked him to put through the long-distance call to the governor's office. He asked Scotty to call the coroner's office in Dallas and ask about the timing of Norma Blanchard's autopsy, while Bill himself placed a call to his house and spoke with Mrs. Cantor about Daisy's condition. While they were occupied, Thatcher wandered over to the county map tacked to the wall and began to study it. He half listened as Bill conversed with his wife's friend and then spoke to the governor's toady. To an outlandish extent, Bill downplayed the seriousness of the previous night's crimes, even referring to it as mischief. When Bill hung up from that call, Thatcher said,
Mind if I get back to work? I've got horses to exercise.
Of course. I've got plenty to do here while Gabe wallows in remorse. If I need you, I'll come find you.
Thatcher left, knowing that he might be hard to find for the next few hours. Neither the sheriff nor anyone else would know where to look. Laurel and Irv transferred the crates he'd brought from the stills to the cellar, where they would be stored until the O'Connors came for them that evening. Irv apologized for being unable to do his share of the lifting, carrying, and moving.
I'd rather you let your arm heal, Laurel told him, as she put the last crate in its place.
She also loaded supplies for Corinne and Ernie into Irv's truck. As he climbed up into the driver's seat, he said,
We'll have to wait and see if hell breaks loose again before we decide whether or not to do runs tonight.
Don't take any chances. If there's the least sign of trouble, lay low. Promise.
I promise. Keep your pistol handy.
She patted her skirt pocket and waved him off. The kitchen was hot, and only got hotter from the ovens as she baked and the afternoon wore on. She had just taken the last pies out of the oven and set them to cool when there was a knock on her front door. It was too early for Davy and Mike, and they always came around to the back. Pushing wisps of damp hair off her heated face, she went through the living room to the front door. The window pane in its upper half gave her clear sight of the callers. Her heart stuttered, but since she'd been seen, she had no choice except to open the door. In the background, a recent model car was parked in the street, a large man standing beside it. Out of reflex, she patted her skirt pocket, but she smiled.
Hello?
Mrs. Plummer, you may not remember meeting me. It was a cursory introduction in
the sheriff's office.
Mayor Bernie Croft said,
Your baby daughter was very ill. I heard about her passing. My condolences are long overdue.
Thank you.
Her gaze shifted to his companion, who removed his bowler hat. The mayor said,
Mr. Landry says you two have met.
Briefly, how do you do, Mr. Landry?
Mrs. Plummer. He gave her a courtly little bow and a smile that flashed gold.
What can I do for you, gentlemen? Sell you a pie?
The mayor laughed.
As delicious as that sounds,
We'd rather you sell us your corn liquor.
Laurel called upon every reserve of discipline she had not to react.
I beg your pardon?
May we come in? Landry said.
With the speed of comets, several options whizzed through her mind. None were good. But the worst of them would be to refuse them entry. That would only arouse suspicion.
Of course.
She stepped aside. Croft and Landry came in. Before shutting the door, she cast a furtive glance toward the car and chauffeur. Her guests looked around at the empty front room. She said,
As you see, I haven't furnished the parlor yet, so I can't offer you a seat.
Personally, I think furnishings would detract from that handsome spandrel, Landry said, and moved to stand under it. Craftsmanship like this is rare these days.
Let's get to business, shall we?
Croft turned to her.
Mrs. Plummer, are you acquainted with a man by the name of Thomas Johnson?
No.
You might never have met him, but you know who he is. He goes by the nickname of Tup.
We found Cousin Tup in a hole in the ground with his arm mangled. Thatcher's words echoed, but she tried to remain impassive.
I'm sorry, I don't know him.
Croft smiled.
Well, he knows you. His arm was caught in a bear trap set by you. He lost the arm.
How terrible for him. But I still have no idea what you're talking about.
I visited him in the hospital yesterday.
So he's a friend of yours?
No. I paid him a courtesy call as a public servant.
It must have cheered him to be so honored.
Not in the slightest. Mr. Johnson used gutter language to denounce me in my elected office. But then he wasn't in the best of moods. The nub is festering. They may have to do additional cutting.
She looked over at Landry, who still had his head back, admiring the room divider. Not a hair out of place.
Mr. Johnson was also elaborately cursing the individual responsible for his misfortune.
He smiled.
You, Mrs. Plummer.
I?
You may think I've come to censure you.
Censure me for what, Mr. Croft? For setting a bear trap, which I would have no earthly idea how to do? It sounds difficult and dangerous.
He pulled his watch out of his vest pocket and checked the time.
I have a schedule, so let's cut to the chase. You were brought to the attention of the disreputable Johnson clan by one Gertrude Atkins.
She went to Hiram. I'm sure you've heard of him, as his name is widely known in moonshiner circles. Gert alleged that it was you who killed Hiram's kinsman, Wally.
Obviously, this woman is deranged.
She also informed Hiram that you are poaching on his family business in the boom towns, and even in many local establishments, including her own. Tup and a younger Johnson, Elray, were sent to your still to teach you a lesson.
How did they know where it was, you ask?
Gert tracked a runaway whore to the shack once occupied by you and your father-in-law. From there, it was easy to find the location of your industry. Is the purpose of Mr. Landry's and my visit becoming clearer now?
No, but this fanciful narrative is entertaining. However, I also have a schedule, Mayor. I'd like for you to leave.
He said,
Don't mistake my reason for being here. I assure you, I didn't come on behalf of the wretched Johnsons. I wish them all in hell.
You see, the Johnsons and I are arch rivals. He smiled again.
You've gotten yourself on their fighting side. I've come to offer you my protection.
You have me at a complete loss. Protection from what?
Capture? Incarceration? If you're lucky, that is. If the Johnsons don't get to you before the law does.
Don't you represent the law, Mr. Mayor?
I represent the business interests of the community.
As well as your own.
If I prosper, everyone does.
Here's how it works. You give me your contacts in the boom towns. Together, Mr. Landry and I can increase that trade double-fold, triple-fold. You'll supply us with all the whiskey you can produce, but we'll take over the distribution. This system greatly decreases the risk to you, your operation, and your associates. We provide this protection for a percentage of the net. I say again, I have no idea what you're talking about.
I'm talking about a 10% take, which is a token, really. You obviously have a very good distiller because your product sells so well. You're savvy, and you have backbone. Admirable qualities, to be sure, especially in a fair lady. But your foremost asset is your friend, Thatcher Hutton, who is now serving as a reserve deputy sheriff. A lot of information could be acquired by sharing a mattress with someone inside the sheriff's office.
Heat rushed to her head. She looked over at Chester Landry, who was watching her with a smarmy smile, as though waiting to see how she was going to worm out of this. She turned back to the mayor.
You insult me, sir. You also insult Mr. Hutton. I have pies delivered to the Boomtowns. Is that what you want a slice of? I didn't think so. Get out of my house.
He grinned, but the smile didn't reach his eyes.
Mrs. Plummer, you're quite charming and glib, but pleading ignorance is a waste of time. Many of the moonshiners, already under my protection, buy from the same suppliers of goods as you. I know exactly how many fruit jars and pounds of sugar your father-in-law purchases for you on a routine basis. I know the gentleman in Weatherford who sold him copper recently. In turn, you've insulted me, my intelligence, by pretending that you aren't distilling illegal whiskey.
I don't even drink.
I'm familiar with this house, he said, seemingly out of context. It has a sizable cellar.
Landry suddenly became animated.
I understand that it backs into the limestone hill, he said. Is that right?
Yes.
What an engineering marvel.
Hardly, Mr. Landry, she said. It's a rather crude construction, actually.
Nevertheless, I would love to see it.
Laurel's heart was in her throat, but she said,
Follow me.
She led them through the dining room, the kitchen, and out the back door. As she began moving aside offshoots of the honeysuckle, Landry asked,
Is the cellar accessible only through this door?
Yes, but the fragrance is so nice, I can't bring myself to prune the vine.
Not only is it lovely to smell, it's useful. It partially conceals the door.
She saw another flash of gold in Landry's jaw when he smiled. She pushed open the door. At the top of the stairs, she said,
Please be careful. These steps are steep and rickety.
Why not turn on the light? The mayor said.
It doesn't work.
He reached up and yanked on the string. The recently installed electric light, which had been one of the projects on Irv's list, came on.
Voila, Landry said.
Laurel tried to look surprised and pleased.
My father-in-law must have changed the bulb. I've been after him to do it.
She preceded the men down the stairs. When she reached the bottom, she turned to face them.
Mr. Landry, note the inexpert connection of the rock wall to the interior. And Mayor Croft, you're quite right about the goods that Irv purchases for me. He's a fix-it man, you know. He's made me copper pots, which I use when stewing fruit for my pie fillings. The recipes call for pounds of sugar. I can barely keep up with my demand for pies, so while fresh fruit is in season, I've made provision for the fall and winter months by canning.
She raised her hands to her sides, inviting them to take a look. The surrounding walls were lined with shelves laden with fruit jars of pie fillings.
51. He would pick the hottest day of the year to do this, Thatcher thought, as he guided his mount into a shallow creek where he reined in the pinto gelding so he could drink. Thatcher uncapped the canteen of water he'd brought with him and drank from it. After draping its strap back over the pommel, he dismounted, took off his bandana, dipped it into the creek water, then wrung it out before tying it back around his neck. The coolness was a welcome relief from the blistering heat and scorching sun. The Pinto was one of Fred Barker's horses for rent. Thatcher had asked if he could take him out for a couple of hours. He also asked to borrow a rifle from Barker, telling him he wanted to get in some target practice. Barker hadn't hesitated to grant both requests, but had remarked that it was one hell of a hot day to be either shooting or taking a pleasure ride. Thatcher wasn't going on this ride for the fun of it. He'd chosen this particular horse because of his stamina. He also needed a stolid horse, one not easily spooked. He didn't know anything about his destination, but he'd envisioned it being desolate, rugged terrain, and he'd been right. He'd ridden cross-country out of town, but had kept the roads in sight, using them and landmarks he'd seen on the county map to guide him to a pass between two sizable hills. He'd found it right where it was supposed to be, Pointer's Gap. The Pinto finished drinking and raised his head. Thatcher patted him on his neck and swung up into the saddle.
Let's go take a look-see.
He adjusted his hat to block the late afternoon sun from his eyes. As he came out the other side of the creek, he pushed the responsive horse into a gallop to cover the last quarter mile of level ground. Before daylight ran out, he wanted to explore as much of the gap as he could. When he reached the twin inclines and the narrow pass cleaving them, he slowed the horse to a walk. He flushed a covey of quail from a grove of mesquite trees. He saw a jackrabbit in a losing race against a bobcat, a nanny goat and two kids that had likely discovered an opening in their owner's fence, and countless horned toads skittering across the crusty earth. A foot-long lizard, dozing on a flat rock, slid to the ground when he and the Pinto clomped past. The wildlife were at home in this inhospitable landscape. They belonged to it and in it. Thatcher was searching for something that didn't belong. Just as the sun was setting, he spotted it. Corinne hummed as she stirred the pot of beans suspended above the cook fire, which she'd let burn down to embers. The sun had set, but even though it wasn't full dark yet, flames would signal their location to anyone, lawmen or outlaws, who might be scouting the area. Seated on side-by-side boulders several yards away from her, Irv and Ernie were watching Corinne, sharing a jar of moonshine and discussing whether or not to risk distilling tonight.
What do you think, Ernie?
Her beans are right tasty.
Irv growled with annoyance.
Not talking about her. What do you think about firing up the stills?
Ernie took off his newsboy cap and fanned his face with it.
What's Laurel say?
She said to lay low at the first sign of trouble. Made me promise. But before that, she was expressing concern about our shortage caused by last night's shutdown.
I hate to worry her about that.
She'd hate to see us landed in jail or shot. So, tell me what you think.
I don't know, Irv. Might be imprudent.
Where'd you get a word like imprudent?
My granddaddy used it whenever he got an itch on the back of his neck. Meant he sensed trouble. He'd say it might be imprudent to cook that night.
Well, I wish he was here to tell us if his neck was itching. But since he ain't, what do you think?
Ernie turned his gaze to Corinne.
If it was just you and me, I'd say to hell with it. Let's take our chances. But it ain't just us two we've got to consider anymore.